Russ Meyer was a film director known for his sexploitation films. They were full of campy humor, clever satire, and women with very large breasts. Most of them were successful. But in 1965, he came out with Faster, Pussycat, Kill, Kill. It was an immediate flop. But now, 50 years later, it's a cult classic. Dean DeFino is the author of a book about the film, and Doug Gordon talks with him about why Faster, Pussycat, Kill, Kill is worth watching, and even rewatching.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence, the word and the act. While violence cloaks itself in a plethora of disguises, its favorite mantle still remains sex. Violence devours all it touches, its voracious appetite rarely fulfilled. Yet violence doesn't only destroy, it creates and molds as well. Let's examine closely then this dangerously evil creation, this new breed, encased and contained within the supple skin of woman. The softness is there, the unmistakable smell of female, the surface shiny and silken, the body yielding yet wanton. But a word of caution, handle with care and don't drop your guard. This rapacious new breed prowls both alone and in packs, operating at any level, any time, anywhere, and with anybody. Who are they? One might be your secretary, your doctor's receptionist, or a dancer in a go-go club.
Dean, can you give me a brief summary of the plot of Russ Meyer's film, Faster, Pussycat, Kill, Kill?
I would start with Russ Meyer's own strapline for the film, which is on the poster, where he describes it using four words. Superwomen belted, buckled, and booted.
Yeah, that sums it up.
I'd be a little bit more descriptive. This would be how I would design that strapline. I would say a trio of thrill-seeking go-go girls with a taste for violence tangle in the desert with a paraplegic, murderous old lech.
You girls a bunch of nudists, or you just short of clothes?
Or thigh, darling.
Why don't you take one of each, son? They both look tender. He's got a big motor to feed.
He sets up a hierarchy in the first actual shot within the film. The three go-go dancers, and they are Tura Satana, who is actually a stripper and dancer, who plays Varla, who's presumably, at least as far as I'm concerned, the leader of the group.
All right, here's how it works. Everybody's got to go.
There's Laurie Williams, who is actually an actor in Elvis Presley films. She plays Billy.
10% of your action be enough for anyone.
And Haji, which is her only name, and she plays Rosie.
It's got nothing to do with the money!
Haji was a fellow stripper that knew Tura Satana very well. In the opening shot, we see the three of them dancing on an elevated stage above a group of drooling burlesque house patrons.
Yeah, go, baby, go!
Go, baby, go! Go, 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 go!
That's right, yeah. So it essentially sets up the power relationship in the film, that the women are seen as sort of objects of desire, but they're also perceived as being in a dominant position, and the men are kind of groveling at their feet.
Let's go now, harder, faster!
Why did you want to write a book about a film that was critically lambasted when it first came out? Some critics called it an exploitative skin flick. Was there any trepidation?
Trepidation, that's an interesting word. Let's just say that I didn't tell a lot of people I was writing the book while I was writing it, because I got a lot of dirty looks when I did. But really, it was in part for that reason, because it had been lambasted and because it had been rejected. I found that often work that draws critical vitriol ends up being really seminal. But really, the primary reason was the way that the film initially impacted me. And again, so much of the critical impulse is about searching out the reasons things excite us.
So how did it impact you?
One of the things that I would say right off the bat is I didn't know while I was watching the movie why it impacted me. And I think I can say now at least two reasons why I think it continues to do so. The first is that it plays with old patriarchal stereotypes of female power that we're sort of familiar with in the story of Amazonian women and sirens and Medusa and so on, which are all these sort of castration anxiety stories. And the second is that I think Meyer, and it's one of the reasons I think that Meyer is so important in the history of American independent film, very skillfully employs the elements of film form to tell his story, that his framings are very precise, his shot compositions and editing, his masterful use of music, his economical pacing. He's very good at drawing the viewer into his story, regardless of how ludicrous that story may be at times.
You have this great description of the cinematic universe, the film world in which Faster Pussycat takes place. You describe it as the sort of desolate wasteland one might expect to find in a zombie movie, co-scripted by F. Scott Fitzgerald and Samuel Beckett. Can you elaborate a bit on that?
Yeah, I'm kind of proud of that line.
You should be. Well, look good on t-shirts and coffee mugs. There's merchandising potential there.
Well, we'll see. One of the overriding themes of modernist writers like Fitzgerald and Beckett is the notion of the existential desolation of the modern world. And you see this in the wasteland that separates West Egg from New York in The Great Gatsby. You see it in the backdrop of Waiting for Godot, which is essentially a tree beside a desolate road that links nothing in particular.
I see existential desolation every time I look in the mirror.
Well, it's a theme that we've begun to embrace again, and this is sort of where I think Meyer comes in. His landscapes embody the same desolation, but rather than leaving his characters to wait in it or to contemplate its meaning, he releases a monster, actually several monsters, into the landscape, and they move relentlessly, driven almost entirely by a violent orgiastic impulse. And I think to a large extent, the success of The Walking Dead recently proves that this idea is pretty durable. Whether we see it in sort of as an evocation of Cold War fears, as you do at the end of the 1960s in Night of the Living Dead, or of consumerist culture in the follow-up to that, Dawn of the Dead, or as a kind of fear of viral epidemic in 28 Days Later or World War Z. It is an idea that really does sort of stick with us. The notion that the world is desolate, but that desolation is also filled with dangers.
Your old man's been blasted out of his wheels, and your king-sized brother's been twisted like a pretzel. You're all that's left, lover, and you ain't gonna be around for long.
I don't believe it.
You'd better believe it.
And they're really, really, really strong female characters, especially Varla, played by Tora Sutana. She's basically a sociopath and a monster.
Yeah, that's the language that I would use. And the reason I would define her as a sociopath is because she's able to entirely suppress her human empathy. So I mean a sociopath in a clinical sense, not just in a symbolic one. A monster in the sense that she embodies those castration anxieties, again, that we see in the Amazon and the siren myths, for example. She lures men in despite their better judgment and robs them of their power, that sort of a thing. But there's a really important distinction in Varla, I think, and what makes her a kind of modern figure. In the ancient version, these monsters are destroyed or thwarted by powerful men, but in Meyer's world, the men are fops and fools, essentially. And though Varla is eventually destroyed, ironically, at the end of the film, she's destroyed by the weakest of the female characters, who runs her over with a truck.
Yeah, what does that say about us, that like Varla is by far the most colorful character in the film, and yet she's a sociopathic monster, yet we identify with her? Is that something conscious? Was Meyer trying to send us a message by doing that?
Yeah, I don't know if he was doing it consciously. I think we are, at some level, meant to identify with Varla as the figure of power in the story, in the same way that we are meant to identify with Jimmy Cagney or Paul Muni in the gangster movies, except that they are distinctly and patriarchally male, and Varla is not. So we sort of run into this problem of how do we find our place in the character of Varla, particularly if Meyer's audience is almost exclusively men at the time that the film is being made.
Yeah. In the process of writing the book and thinking about this, have you come to any conclusions about how do we find our place?
Well, I think we found our place gradually. I think the discourse has caught up with the film to a certain extent, as Ruby Rich claims in her review of the film in 1995 when it was re-released. where she talks about how when she first saw the film in the 1970s, it flew in the face of her idea of right-on feminism, mm-hmm. but then filtered through the lens of the feminist and queer criticism that began to really sort of take root in the 80s and early 1990s, she began to see that Meyer's work was actually ahead of its time in the way that it dealt with representations of female power. But I think even more importantly, in our time, in 2015, how Meyer sort of reconsiders the idea of gender roles and gender traits. He saw as women as a sort of amalgam of traditionally defined male and female traits, in fact. Yeah. And at a time when issues of gender identification are so much a part of our public discourse, I think Meyer's films offer us plenty of food for thought.
You wanted to write this book to understand how and why Faster Pussycat Kill Kill spoke to some deeper, more sinister part of your brain. Have you reached any conclusions?
Well, to be honest, I'd rather keep them to myself and let you investigate the sinister part of your own brain.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, and there's a lot of territory to mine there. I'm still doing a lot of work there. I got to bring in some extra cartographers.
A cult film is built on paradoxes, and the one we most often hear is it's so bad it's good. In a great cult film, those paradoxes approach something close to the profound. And here is where I think Pussycat is a really good example. It's ahead of its time, but it's also of its time. It's both highly sexual and in some ways chaste. It's a mess of plot points and crazy dialogue, but you never feel lost in it. It's an amalgam of cliches from every popular youth genre of the time, including beach party movies and biker movies and juvenile delinquent movies, yet it somehow manages to hit you at a gut level. It's been read as feminist and anti-feminist, and I think that that's what makes it worthy of repeat viewing. And it's also one of the hallmarks of cult film, obviously. If the film isn't compelling you to watch it over and over again for the pleasure, but also to sort of help to mitigate the mystery of it in some way, to try to understand it better, or at least to become more involved in the mysterious thing that draws you to it, then it doesn't become a cult film. Cult film requires repeat viewing.
For an incredible evening's entertainment, a film so totally satisfying, see Russ Meyer's Faster Pussycat Kill Kill.
Dean DeFino is an English professor and director of film studies at Iona College in New York. He's the author of Faster Pussycat Kill Kill. He talked with Doug Gordon.